that she ever would again. In the morning, Colin drove Maria home and waited in the living room while she showered and changed, but he didn't join her for brunch at her parents'. He understood that right now, she needed to be alone with her family, a haven of stability and predictability amid a life that suddenly felt wildly off course. He walked her to her car, and while they embraced, she found herself holding back slightly. At the house, her parents were oblivious, but Serena figured out something was bothering Maria as soon as she stepped inside, something Maria didn't want to share with her parents. Serena played along perfectly, maintaining a stream of commentary as they cooked and ate, filling any silences with the sound of her voice, and keeping the conversation from drifting toward anything serious. Afterward, Maria and Serena went for a walk. As soon as they reached a safe distance from the house, Serena turned and said, "Spill it." On a bench beneath an elm tree with leaves that had begun to turn gold, Maria told Serena everything that had happened, reliving the terror of the past several days. And when she started to cry, Serena began to cry as well. Like Maria, Serena was upset and scared. Like Maria, she had more questions than answers. Questions at which Maria could only shake her head. After lunch, Serena and her parents headed off to Maria's uncle's house, an informal family get-together like countless others, but Maria begged off, claiming she had a headache and wanted to take a nap. While her dad accepted the explanation without question, Maria's mother was dubious, though she knew enough not to press her. On the way out the door, she hugged Maria longer than usual and asked how things were going with Colin. The sound of his name brought a sudden wellspring of tears, and on her way to the car, Maria thought, "I've officially become a basket case." Even concentrating enough to drive was strangely difficult. Despite the traffic, all she could think was that someone was watching her, waiting for her to return. Or maybe he was even following her now. Impulsively, she changed lanes and made a quick turn onto a side street, her eyes glued to the rearview mirror. She turned again, then once more before finally pulling over. And though she wanted to be strong, pleaded with God to help her be strong, she found herself bent over the steering wheel, sobbing. Who was he and what did he want? The nameless, faceless man in the baseball cap. Why hadn't she looked for him? All she remembered were shadows and fragments, nothing at all. But there was more, too, something that kept her anxious and on the verge of tears. Without thinking, she put the car in gear and started driving, eventually making her way to a quiet stretch of Carolina Beach. The day was cool, and the breeze held the nip of the coming winter as she walked the sand. Clouds had rolled in, white and gray, and it felt like impending rain. The waves rolled in calming rhythm, and as she walked, she finally felt her thoughts beginning to settle long enough for a bit of clarity to emerge. She wasn't on edge simply because she was being followed, nor was she merely reliving the fear she felt for Colin as he'd stood with the police officers with the rest of his life hanging in the balance. She saw now that she was also afraid of Colin. And as sick as the thought made her feel, she couldn't push the feeling away. Knowing that she needed to talk to Colin, Maria drove to Evans. When Colin opened the door to his apartment, she saw that he had been studying at a small kitchen table. Though he invited her in, she declined, the interior of his place appearing suddenly claustrophobic. Instead, they went to Evan's porch, each taking a seat in a rocking chair as the rain began to fall. Colin perched on the edge of his seat, forearms resting on his legs. He looked tired, the last 24 hours obviously taking a toll. He did nothing to break the silence, and for a moment, Maria wasn't even sure where to begin. "I've been on edge ever since last night," she ventured. "So if I'm not making much sense, it's probably because my thoughts are still jumbled." She drew a breath. "I mean, I know you were just trying to help me. But Lily was right. Even though I believe you when you say that you weren't going to hurt the waitress, the way you were acting told a different story."
I almost lost control.
"No," she said. "You did lose control."
"I can't control my emotions. The only thing I can control is my behavior, and I didn't touch her."
"Don't try to minimize what happened."
"I'm not trying to minimize it."
"What if you get angry with me?"
I would never hurt you. And like the waitress, I might end up terrified and in tears anyway. If you'd acted like that toward me, I'd never want to talk to you again. And then, with Evan, I didn't do anything to Evan. But had it been anyone else who grabbed you, a guy you didn't know, you wouldn't have been able to stop, and you know it. Just like Margolis said. She made sure to hold his gaze. Or are you going to lie to me for the first time and say I'm wrong? I was scared for you because the guy was there. But what you did didn't make it better. I just wanted to find out what he looked like. And you don't think I do? She said, raising her voice. But tell me this. What if he'd still been there, just sitting at the bar? What would you have done then? Do you honestly believe that you were capable of having a reasonable conversation with him? No. You would have overreacted, and right now, you'd be in prison. I'm sorry. You already apologized. She hesitated. As much as we've discussed your past, and as much as I thought I knew you, I realize that I don't. Last night, you weren't the guy I fell in love with, or even a guy I would have dated. Instead, I saw someone that, in my past, I would have gladly put away. What are you trying to say? I don't know, she said. All I know is that I don't have the energy to start worrying that you'll do something dumb and throw your life away, or that you'll end up frightening me because something inside you suddenly switches on. It's not your job to worry about me. At his comment, she flushed, all her fears and anxieties and anger rising to the surface like an air bubble moving through water. Don't be a hypocrite! What the hell do you think all that was about last night? Or the past week, for that matter? You hid out on a roof for hours to take pictures of my boss, called every florist in the city, and drove 2 hours to show a stranger a photograph. You did that because you were worried about me. And now you're saying that I'm not allowed to worry about you? Why is it okay for you to worry but not for me? Maria, let me finish, she demanded. I told you that what was happening to me wasn't your problem. I told you to let it go, but you were dead set on doing whatever the hell you wanted. And okay, maybe you did talk me into letting you take the photos, because you made it sound like you knew what you were doing, like you could handle it. But based on last night, you obviously can't. You were almost arrested. And then what would have happened? Do you have any idea what that would have done to me? How I would have felt? She pressed her fingers to her eyelids and was trying to organize her thoughts when she heard her cell phone ring. Pulling it from her pocket, she recognized Serena's number and wondered why she was calling. Hadn't she said something about going on a date? She answered and instantly heard the panic in Serena's voice, the words spilling out in rapid Spanish. Come home now! Serena sobbed before Maria could say a single word. Maria felt her chest constrict. What's wrong? Is Dad okay? What happened? It's Mom and Dad, because of Copo. She's dead. Chapter 17. Colin. Colin worried that Maria was too shaky to get behind the wheel, so he drove her car to her parents' house, trying to read her mood as she stared out the rain-splattered window. Between her sobs, Serena hadn't been able to tell Maria much. No one really knew anything other than that Copo was dead. As soon as they pulled into the driveway, Maria rushed into the house, Colin trailing behind. Her parents sat holding each other on the sofa, haggard and red-eyed. Serena stood near the kitchen, wiping at her tears. Felix stood from the couch as soon as Maria entered, and they both began weeping. Soon, the whole family was standing with their arms around each other, crying, while Colin stood quietly in the doorway. When their tears abated, they all collapsed on the couch, Maria continuing to hold her father's hand. They were speaking in Spanish, so he couldn't follow much of the story, but he heard more than enough to let him know that the dog's death had made no sense at all. Later, he sat with Maria on the back porch, and she caught him up on what she'd learned, which wasn't much. Her parents and Serena had gone to their relatives after brunch, and while normally they'd bring the dog, there were going to be a lot of kids there, and they'd been worried that Copo might get overwhelmed, or worse, accidentally hurt. Serena had returned to the house an hour later because she'd left her cell phone charging on the kitchen counter. When Serena saw Copo lying near the back slider, which had been left open, she assumed the dog was sleeping. But when the dog hadn't moved by the time she was about to leave, Serena called out to her. Coppo didn't respond, so Serena went to check on her, only to realize that the dog had died. She called her parents, who drove straight home, and then Maria.
Coppo was fine before they left. She'd eaten and wasn't acting sick. There was nothing for her to have choked on, and my dad didn't find anything in her throat. There wasn't any blood or vomit.
She drew a shaky breath.
It's like she died for no reason, and my dad, I've never seen him cry before. He brought her everywhere. They hardly ever left her alone. You can't understand how much he loved that little dog.
I can only imagine, he said.
Maybe, she said. But still, you have to understand that in the village my parents came from, dogs work or herd or spend time with you in the field, but they aren't regarded as pets. My father never understood the American love affair with dogs. Both Serena and I begged for a dog when we were younger, but he was adamantly opposed. And then, when Serena and I left home, there was suddenly a gigantic void in his life. At some point, someone suggested they get a dog, and this time, it was like a light suddenly went on for him. Coppo was like his child, but more obedient and devoted.
She shook her head, quiet for a moment.
She's not even 4 years old. I mean, can a dog just die? Have you ever heard of that happening before?
No. She'd expected the answer, but it didn't help, and her thoughts circled back to the reason she'd needed to talk to him.
Colin, about what we were talking about earlier.
You were right, about everything. She sighed.
I care about you, Colin. I love you and want nothing more than to be with you, but...
The word but hung heavy in the air. I'm not who you thought I was.
No. She said, you're exactly who I thought you were, and you warned me right up front. And I thought I could handle it, but last night, I realized that I don't think I can.
What does that mean? She tucked a strand of hair behind her ear.
I think that for right now, it might be best to slow things down a bit. Between us, I mean. With all that's going on.
She didn't finish, but she didn't have to. What are you going to do about the guy following you?
I don't know. It's hard for me to even think straight right now.
That's what he wants. He wants you worried and afraid, constantly on edge. She pushed her hands into her hair, kneading her temples. When she spoke, her voice was ragged.
Right now, I feel like I'm stuck in this awful dream and all I want to do is wake up. And on top of everything else, I have to support my parents. My dad wants to bury Coppo tonight, and that's only going to make him even more emotional. My mom, too. And this rain. Of all the weekends for Coppo to die, why this one?
Colin peered out of the backyard. How about I help get things ready? Maria brought him a shovel from the garage, and after a little back and forth between Maria and Felix, Colin started digging a hole in the shade of an oak tree, rain soaking through his shirt. He remembered doing the same thing for his own dog, Penny, a long-haired miniature dachshund. The dog had slept with him in bed when he'd still been living at home, and while at school, he'd missed her more than his family. He remembered how hard it had been to dig the grave the summer after his sophomore year. It was one of the few times he could recall crying since the first year he'd been sent away. With every shovelful of dirt, he'd had a memory of Penny, running through the grass or nipping at a butterfly, and he wanted to spare Felix that. The task also got him away from Maria. He understood her need for space right now, even if he didn't like thinking about the reason. He knew he'd screwed up royally, and right now, she was probably trying to figure out whether Colin was worth the risk. When Colin finished digging the pit under the tree, the family buried Coppo. Again, all four of them cried and exchanged hugs. And after they went back inside, Colin began to shovel the dirt back in place, his thoughts returning to the stalker and the fact that Maria was being followed. He wondered what the stalker's next move might be, and he decided then and there that whether Maria wanted him in her life or not, he would be there if she ever needed him.
Are you sure? Maria asked him, standing with him on the front porch. I'd be happy to drive you home.
Inside, Carmen and Serena were making dinner. Felix, as far as Colin knew, was still on the back porch, sitting alone and holding Coppo's collar. I'll be okay. I need to run anyway.
But it's still raining.
I'm already wet.
Isn't that kind of far? Like 5 or 6 miles?
You need to stay here with your family, he said, and for a moment neither of them said anything. Can I call you? He finally asked. Her gaze flickered toward the house before returning to him.
Why don't I call you?
He nodded before taking a step backward, and without another word, he turned and began to run. Maria didn't call for the rest of the week, and it was the first time in his life that he cared enough about a girl for that to actually matter to him. Or enough for him to even think about it in unexpected moments or whenever the phone rang, which wasn't often. He wasn't going to call her. He wanted to. More than once, he'd actually reached for his phone before reminding himself she'd asked him not to. Whether she eventually called or not was her choice. To keep from dwelling on it, he tried to stay busy. He added an extra shift at work, and after his classes and before his shifts, he spent time at the gym, working with Daly and Moore. They were more excited about the upcoming fight than he was. While fighting someone like Reese was a rare opportunity to measure his own skill level, win or lose, it wouldn't mean much for him in the long run. For Daly and Moore, a good match might mean a minor windfall for the gym. No wonder they spent the first 2 hours on Monday reviewing films of Reese's former fights, with Colin studying his tendencies and evaluating strengths and weaknesses.
He's good, but he's not unbeatable, Daly continued to insist, more in agreement.
Colin listened while trying to tune out comments that he regarded as too wishful or optimistic, basically anything that had the words Reese and ground in the same sentence. Reese would eat him alive on the ground. On the plus side, the films showed that Colin's skills were slightly better than Reese's when it came to striking, especially kicks. To that point in his career, not a single fighter had gone after Reese with kicks to the knees, despite Reese offering numerous opportunities. Reese also left himself open to shots at the ribs after any combination, which was useful to know when planning a strategy. The problem was that when the fight actually started, strategies often went right out the window, but that's where, according to Daly and Moore, Colin had the biggest advantage.
Reese hasn't ever fought anyone with more than 6 or 7 fights under his belt, which meant his opponents have been both outclassed and intimidated. You won't be intimidated, and that will rattle him more than anything.
Daly and Moore were right. Fighting, whether in bars, the street, or even the ring, wasn't only about skill, but confidence and control as well. It was all about waiting for the right moment and then taking advantage of it. It was about experience when adrenaline was pumping, and Colin had had more fights than Reese. Reese had been an athlete, someone who shook hands with his opponent after a match. Colin was the kind of guy who struck first and broke beer bottles over people's heads at the end, the sole intent to cause as much damage as quickly as possible. With that said, Reese was undefeated for a reason. On his best day, Colin figured he had only a 1 in 4 chance of winning, and that was only if he was able to make it through the first couple of rounds. The kicks to the knees and rib shots, the coaches continued to assure him, would wear Reese down the longer the fight went on. The third round will be yours, they promised. On Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, they got to work, with 1 hour and 15 minutes each day devoted to specific strikes. Daly got in the ring wearing sturdy knee braces and a vest, demanding that Colin make kicks to the knees, offering openings and then taking them away. Simultaneously, Moore instructed Colin to keep his distance and concentrate on the ribs after every combination Daly threw. Their exhortations heated and demanding. In the last 45 minutes, Colin focused on groundwork, honing defensive techniques. They were all fully aware that Reese had a significant advantage in this area, and the best that Colin could hope for was to survive. He'd never trained for a specific opponent, and it proved frustrating. He missed with kicks and was too slow with strikes to the ribs. All too often, he allowed himself to get tied up, which was exactly what Reese would want. It wasn't until Thursday that the light bulb flickered on, albeit dimly, and when he walked out of the gym, he wished he had another couple of weeks to get ready. Friday was a rest day, the first day that Colin hadn't worked out in over a year, and he needed the break. Everything hurt. With no classes, he spent the morning and afternoon completing 2 papers. Later, at work, with cooler temperatures setting in, hardly any customers showed up on the rooftop, even during the dinner rush. By 9, there were no patrons at all, and Colin had the place to himself. Tips had been almost non-existent, but it gave him time to reflect on the previous weekend. Or, more specifically, the question Maria had asked that had been plaguing him on and off ever since. Of all the weekends for Coppo to die, why this one? There was nothing to suggest that the guy who was following Maria was responsible for Coppo's death, but there wasn't anything that rendered the idea implausible, either. If the guy knew where Maria lived, it was more than conceivable he also knew where her parents lived. The backslider had been left open. Coppo had been fine when they left, and 3 hours later the dog was dead for no apparent reason. Colin knew it wouldn't have taken much to have snapped Coppo's neck or choked the dog to death. Or, on the other hand, the dog could have died a natural, if unexplained, death. He wondered whether the same terrible thoughts had occurred to Maria. If so, she would also suspect that the stalking had escalated to a new level, and he wondered whether she would call him. If not as her lover, then as a friend who'd promised to be there for her. Colin checked his phone. She hadn't called. Colin spent Saturday morning trying to get ahead in his reading, though by noon, he wasn't sure why he'd even bothered. Nerves kept him from recalling anything of substance. He wasn't hungry, either. It had been all he could do to force down a couple of protein smoothies. The feeling of nerves was new to him. He reminded himself that he didn't care about winning, but at the same time, he also admitted he was lying to himself. If he didn't care how he did in the ring, why watch everything he ate or drank? Why train 2 or 3 times a day? And would he have agreed to spend all week preparing for Johnny Reese? Fact was, he hadn't yet walked into the cage thinking he'd lose a fight. Amateurs were amateurs. But Reese was different. Reese could give him a beatdown if Colin made a single wrong move. Reese was just plain better. Unless my strategy pays off. He felt a sudden, unexpected surge of adrenaline. Not good. Too early. He'd be wasted before the fight even started, and he had to get his mind off it. Best way to do that was to go for a run to clear his mind, even if his coaches would want him to conserve his energy. Too bad. He ran anyway. It was only partly successful. Hours later, Colin sat alone in the makeshift dressing room. He'd been weighed, as had his gloves. Daly made sure that the amount of athletic tape on his hands met regulations. Colin opted to wear a cup, and his shoes were inspected by officials. Tons of rules, even at the amateur level. There were only 10 minutes before his fight began, and he'd asked Daly and Moore to leave him, even though he knew they wanted to stay. Their attitude pissed him off. In the minutes leading up to any fight, pretty much everything and everyone pissed him off, which was just what he wanted. He thought about knee and rib strikes. He thought about keeping Reese rattled and owning the third round. Already the adrenaline was making every muscle taut, his senses heightened. Beyond the walls, he heard the roar of the crowd, then heard as it became even louder. No doubt a fighter was exerting his will over another, the match clearly coming to an end, an opponent getting pummeled. Colin drew a long breath. Showtime. The next thing he knew, he was face to face with Reese at the center of the cage, each of them sizing the other up while the referee went over the rules. No biting, no kicks to the nuts, etc. As they stared at each other, the world began to shrink, sounds diminishing, and then the fighters were released to their corners. Daly and Moore shouted encouragement, but Colin only vaguely registered their voices. The bell sounded, and he stepped forward. Colin landed a kick to Reese's knee within the first 20 seconds, then another 2 quickly after that. All 3 shots seemed to catch Reese off guard, and when Colin hit the knee a 4th time, he saw Reese's first flash of anger. A 5th kick to the knee came next, and Reese began keeping his distance, already having deciphered part of Colin's plan. They traded blows for the next couple of minutes, with Colin landing 3 quality shots to the ribs and 1 more hard kick to the knee. Reese's boxing skills were about what Colin had expected, but his punches were harder, and when Reese landed a shot to Colin's temple, Colin saw stars and ended up on his back. Reese was clearly in control, but Colin was able to hold his own defensively until the bell sounded. Both fighters were breathing hard. According to Daly, the round could go either way, though he thought Colin had the advantage. The second round followed roughly the same pattern. Colin landed three more kicks to the knee, with Reese noticeably wincing after the final shot. Colin hammered on Reese's ribs whenever the opportunity presented itself. Two-thirds of the way through, they were on the ground again, with Reese landing a couple of strong blows while Colin did everything he could to defend himself. In the final 20 seconds, Reese's elbow connected with the bridge of Colin's nose and opened up a gash. Blood seeped into his eye, he lost concentration, and Reese took advantage, twisting his leg until Colin nearly had to tap. Colin knew as he returned to his corner that while he hadn't been completely dominated, he'd lost the round. He also noticed that Reese was limping badly as he made his way back to his corner. Colin attacked the knee again to open the third round, then jabbed and feinted a couple of rushes, returning to the knee repeatedly. On the final kick, Reese winced hard and instinctively bent over. Colin moved in and went hard to the ribs. Out of position, Reese tried to lock up Colin, but Colin brought up his knee, felt it connect with Reese's forehead, and for the first time in the match, had Reese on his back and seriously in trouble. Colin went as hard as he could, striking with his fists and elbows. Reese hadn't been in this position very often, and Colin could sense him begin to panic. Colin continued to strike, landing more blows with as much force as possible. Reese took a hard shot to the jaw, and his body went slack. Colin landed three more shots that left Reese stunned. Colin pressed his advantage, and as the round ticked toward its close, Reese made a tactical mistake. Colin was nearly able to end the fight with an armbar, only to have Reese somehow wiggle free. Precious seconds ticked by before Colin maneuvered Reese into position for another armbar. Just as Colin began to apply pressure, the bell sounded, the referee jumped in, and the fight was over. Colin reluctantly rose only to see Daly and Moore pumping their fists. In their minds, it was clear who'd won the fight. Reese's too. As he rose, he avoided Colin's eyes. The judges, however, didn't score it that way. When Reese's arm was raised in victory by a plainly skeptical referee, Colin knew that he'd just been handed his first defeat. Colin shook Reese's hand, and Daly and Moore charged into the ring. The crowd began to boo and catcall. Colin tuned it all out. He was spent. He left the cage and headed toward the locker room alone, only mildly disappointed and not terribly surprised.
"If it's any consolation, you don't look nearly as bad as you did after your last fight," Evan noted.
As was becoming a custom after Colin's fights, they were at a sketchy roadside diner, Evan watching Colin eat.
"Just that little cut on the bridge of your nose, but other than that, you're good.
Which is definitely an improvement. Last time you could have passed for Rocky after the fight with Apollo Creed. And that guy sucked.
He headbutted me.
He might have cheated in the fight, but unlike tonight, the decision in that one was fair.
You know you kicked his ass, right? It wasn't even close. The crowd knew it, and so did the referee. Did you see his face when they announced Reese?"
"No."
"He couldn't believe it. Even Reese's coach was shocked."
Colin used his fork to slice into his pancakes and stabbed a mouthful.
"Okay. If it had gone on another 20 seconds, Reese would have tapped out. Maybe 10. There was no way he was stopping that last armbar because he was toast by then. The guy could barely do anything at that point."
"I know."
"Then why aren't you more upset? Your coaches are pissed as hell. You should be pissed too."
"Because it's over," Colin answered. "There's nothing I can do now."
"You could register a protest."
"No."
"Then at the very least, you should have clocked Reese when he started doing that stupid dance after the announcement. Did you see that?"
"No."
"The fight had to be rigged. They wanted Reese to finish his amateur career undefeated."
"Who's they?"
"I don't know. The judges, the promoter, whoever. My point is, the fix was in."
"The fix was in? You sound like a character in a gangster movie."
"I'm just saying that no matter what you did, short of knocking him out or having him tap out, Reese was going to win that fight."
Colin shrugged. "Reese is heading to the pros. I was a last-minute fill-in. It's better for everyone if he finished undefeated as an amateur."
"You're kidding. That stuff matters?"
"Not officially.
but produce a fighter from this area that gets to the UFC and it's good for everyone.
You make it sound like a business, not a sport.
It's the truth. Evan shook his head.
Fine. Be philosophical about it or whatever. Do you think you won?
Colin took a forkful of eggs.
Yes.
After a moment, Evan shook his head.
I still think you should have clocked him when he started doing that dance. Hell, I wanted to clock him.
Okay. Evan leaned back in his seat.
All right, then. Since you're fine with it, I'm glad I got to watch you get your ass kicked, especially after that fiasco last weekend.
Okay.
And there's something else, too.
Yeah.
Maria was there tonight.
Colin lifted his chin, instantly alert.
She was with another girl who could have been her twin, Evan added. Well, not exactly like her, but close enough. You know what I mean. They were on the opposite side of the ring, way in the back, but it was her, without a doubt.
Okay.
What's going on with the two of you anyway?
Colin forked a piece of sausage. I don't know.
Chapter 18. Maria.
Thanks again for coming,
Maria said to Serena on the drive back to Wilmington. The rain blew in soft sheets, making the oncoming headlights shimmer.
It was fun,
Serena said from the passenger seat, a soda wedged between her legs.
It was also one of the more interesting Saturday nights I've had in a long time. I think I actually know one of the fighters.
Duh, Maria said. You were the one who set us up.
I'm not talking about Colin. I'm talking about one of the other fighters. I think I've seen him on campus. Of course, from where we were standing, it's not as though I could be certain. Tell me again why we didn't try to get closer.
Because I didn't want Colin to know I was there.
And again, why is that?
Because we haven't talked since last weekend, Maria said. I already told you all of this.
I know, I know. He yelled at the waitress and the police came and you got all freaked out. Blah, blah, blah.
I appreciate your sympathy.
I'm sympathetic. I just think you're making a mistake.
You didn't say that last Sunday.
Well, I've had a chance to think about it. And on that note, thanks for keeping me in the dark about the stalker until then.
Her voice dripped sarcasm, but Maria couldn't really blame her.
I didn't know for sure until then. And when did you find out? Colin was right there trying to get answers.
He was doing way more than that.
Would you rather date the kind of guy who does nothing? Who would sit there like a log? Or would you have wanted him to take charge of the situation? Hell, if I'd been there, I would probably have yelled at that dingbat waitress too. Who can't remember what someone looks like a few minutes after they've ordered a drink?
I saw a side of Colin that I didn't like.
So what? Do you think that Mom hasn't seen a side of Dad that she doesn't like? Or vice versa? I've seen a side of you that I don't like, but I wouldn't shut you out of my life.
What side?
Does it matter?
Yes.
Fine. You always think you're right. It bugs me.
No, I don't.
You're making my point. And you're beginning to irritate me. Someone's got to keep you in line and tell you when you're wrong. And on that note, you're wrong about Colin, too. You should call him. He's good for you.
I'm not so sure of that.
Then why did you insist that we come watch him fight tonight?
Why had she wanted to come tonight? She'd waffled, telling Serena that she'd promised Colin that she would, but Serena had merely scoffed.
Just admit that you still like him, she'd said.
Last weekend, it had been clear that she needed some space to think. Her whip-sawing emotions about the stalker, about Colin, had left her feeling wildly off-kilter. A feeling that only grew worse as the week wore on. Even the atmosphere at work felt odd to her. Ken had been in and out of Barney's office most of the week, looking distracted and worried, though he didn't so much as mumble a single word to her. Barney was equally tense. Both he and Ken weren't in the offices at all on Thursday, and when Lynn didn't show up for work on either Thursday or Friday, she'd expected Barney to raise hell as soon as he returned, if only because Lynn hadn't so much as called to say she wouldn't be coming in. However, Barney had simply added Lynn's work to Maria's plate without explanation or comment. Strange. Her parents, too, were a concern. Still grieving over Copo, her dad was depressed to the point that he'd stopped going into the restaurant, and her mom was worried about him. Maria had dinner with him on Tuesday and Thursday evenings, Serena on Monday and Wednesday, and on the way to Colin's fight, they'd both agreed that something needed to be done, even if they weren't quite sure if there was anything they could do. The fight was supposed to be a distraction, or at least that's what she'd tried to tell herself. Serena, too. But as soon as Colin had stepped into the cage, she'd felt an almost nauseating wave of butterflies, coupled with an acute sense of regret. All of which meant, what? With her parents grieving, the idea of begging off their usual Sunday brunch was out of the question, even if she didn't feel as though she was in the right frame of mind to support anyone. Which was why the sight of Serena on the front porch, almost vibrating with expectant energy, caught Maria off guard. As soon as Maria pulled into the drive, Serena skipped over. "What's going on?" "I know what we have to do," Serena said, "and I have no idea why it took this long to figure it out, other than that I'm an idiot. On the plus side, you and I are going to get our lives back. I mean, I love Mom and Dad, but I can't keep coming over here for dinner a couple of times a week and having brunch on Sunday. I already have to spend time with them at the restaurant, and I need a little space, you know?" "What are you talking about?" "I've thought of something to help Mom and Dad." Maria stepped out of the car. "How are they?" "Not great." "This should be interesting. Like I said, I have a plan." It took some coaxing, but despite their reservations, Maria's parents weren't the kind to say no to their kids, especially when the girls were united in their pleas. Climbing into their dad's SUV, they drove to the Humane Society. When they'd reached the parking lot of a low-slung, nondescript building, Maria couldn't help but notice how her parents dragged their feet, reluctance written in their every step. "It's too soon," their mother had protested when Serena first introduced the idea.
"We'll just see what's available," Serena had reassured them. "No pressure."
Now they trailed behind their daughters, moving slowly toward the doors.
"I'm not so sure this is a good idea," Maria hissed, leaning closer to Serena. "What if they don't have a dog here that he likes?
Remember how I told you that Steve volunteers here? Well, after I told him about Copo, Steve mentioned that there's one dog that just might be perfect," Serena whispered back. "He even agreed to meet us here.
Did you ever consider getting him another Shih Tzu? From the same breeder where they got Copo?"
"Of course I did," Serena said. "But I didn't want them to think we were trying to replace Copo."
"Isn't that exactly what we're doing?"
"Not if it's a different kind of dog."
Maria wasn't as confident in Serena's logic as her sister obviously was, but she said nothing. Steve, looking visibly nervous, greeted them as soon as they entered. After Serena offered him a hug, she introduced him to her parents. Steve eagerly led them into the back toward the kennels. Dogs immediately began to bark, the sound echoing off the walls. They walked slowly past the first few kennels. There was a lab mix, a pit bull mix, and some sort of terrier, and she noted her parents' apathy. Ahead of them, Serena and Steve stopped at one of the smaller kennels.
"How about this one?" Serena called out.
Felix and Carmen headed over to her, moving reluctantly, like they'd rather be anywhere else. Maria trailed in their wake.
"What do you think?" Serena pressed.
In the kennel, Maria saw a small black and brown dog with a face like a teddy bear's, sitting on its haunches, making no noise at all. Maria had to admit that it was just about the cutest thing she'd ever seen.
"He's a Shorkie Tzu," Steve offered. "It's a mix between a Shih Tzu and a Yorkshire Terrier. He's very sweet and between 2 and 3 years old."
Steve opened the kennel. Reaching in, he picked up the dog and offered it to Felix.
"Would you mind carrying him outside? He'd probably love some fresh air."
With a trace of lingering reluctance, Felix cradled the dog. Carmen leaned in curiously. Maria watched as the little dog licked her father's fingers before yawning with a squeak. Within minutes, Felix was in love, as was Carmen. Serena stood by watching them, holding Steve's hand, clearly pleased with herself. Not that Maria could blame her. No wonder she'd been shortlisted for the scholarship. Serena was sometimes absolutely brilliant. When Maria returned to work on Monday, the tension in the office was palpable. Everyone was on edge, paralegals whispering to each other over the partitions of their cubicles, growing silent whenever any of the attorneys approached. Meanwhile, Maria learned that all the partners had been closeted in the conference room since the very early morning, which could only signify that something major was brewing. Lynn was absent for the third consecutive workday, and with no idea what she was supposed to do, Barney had neglected to leave her any instructions, Maria poked her head into Jill's office. Before she could get a word out, Jill began shaking her head and talking loudly enough to be heard in the hallway.
"Of course we're still on for lunch," Jill announced. "I can't wait to hear about your weekend. It sounds amazing."
The partners were still behind closed doors when Maria finally took a seat across the table from Jill at a nearby restaurant.
"What in the world is going on today? It's like some sort of twilight zone back there. And what are the partners talking about? No one seems to know anything."
Jill expelled a long breath.
"It's all very hush-hush right now, but I'm sure you've noticed the absence of your paralegal. Does she have something to do with what's going on?"
"You could say that,"
Jill muttered, trailing off when the waiter approached to take their drink orders. She waited until the waiter had walked away before speaking again.
"We'll get to that," she said. "And I'll answer what I can. Mainly, I wanted to have lunch with you because I wanted to run something by you in confidence."
"Yeah, of course," Maria said.
"Are you happy working at the firm?"
"I'm doing okay. Why?"
"Because I was wondering if you'd ever consider leaving and coming to work with me at my own firm."
Maria was too stunned to formulate an answer. Jill nodded.
"I know it's a big decision, and you don't need to give me an answer right now. But I want you to think about it, especially now, given what's going on."
"I still don't know what's going on. And wait, you're leaving? We've been working on our plans since before you started here."
"We?"
"I'll be working with Leslie Shaw. She's an employment attorney with Scanton, Dilley, and Marsden, and we went to law school together. She's terrific, sharp as a tack, and shrewd when it comes to labor law. I'd like you to meet her if you're open to the idea of maybe coming to work with us. You'd have to like her, of course, but if you have no desire to leave, then I hope you'll forget I said anything at all. For now, we're trying to keep this as quiet as possible."
"I won't say anything," Maria promised, the shock still reverberating.
"And of course I'd be willing to meet her, but why are you thinking about leaving?"
"Because our firm is in trouble, like Titanic hitting the iceberg trouble. And the next few months aren't going to be pretty."
"What do you mean?"
"Our managing partner, Ken, is about to get sued by Len for sexual harassment. And I'm guessing that two, maybe even three other paralegals are also going to sue. That's what the partners have been meeting about all day. Because it's going to make the news and it's going to be ugly. From what I heard, the private mediation didn't go well last week."
"What mediation?"
"Last Thursday."
"Which explains why Lynn, Barney, and Ken were absent. Why haven't I heard anything about this?"
"Because Lynn hasn't filed with the EEOC yet."
"Then why was there a mediation at all?"
"Because Ken was warned about it a couple weeks back and has been doing everything he can to head it off. You've noticed, I'm sure, that he's been on his best behavior since then. He's terrified. I'm sure he expects the firm to negotiate a settlement, and I'm sure the other partners are balking at that. They want Ken to make it go away, but he doesn't have the money."
"How can he not have the money?
Two ex-wives? And this isn't the first time it's happened. Ken has settled before. That's why I used to ask you about him. Because you're young and attractive and you work in the office, which is all it takes as far as Ken is concerned. The guy does all his thinking from below the waist. And of course, Lynn will claim that the partners were all in cahoots with him since they knew exactly what kind of guy he was and never did anything about it. The firm could be staring at a multi-million dollar payout. And let's just say that a lot of clients aren't going to want to be associated with a firm known for rampant sexual harassment. Which brings me back to my original question. Are you open to the idea of joining Leslie and me at a new firm?"
Maria was overwhelmed.
"I don't have employment law experience."
"I understand, but I'm not worried. You're smart and driven, and you'll pick up on it faster than you probably imagine. The one caveat is that we're probably not going to be able to match your salary from the get-go. But you'll have more flexible hours. And just by joining on day one, you'd be on the fast track to becoming a partner.
When are you thinking of leaving?
4 weeks from Friday, she said. We've already leased and furnished an office a few blocks from here. All the paperwork is filed.
I'm sure there are others out there who are much more qualified. So why me?
Why not you? Jill smiled.
We're friends, and if I've learned one thing in this profession, it's that work is a lot more enjoyable when you like the people you spend your days with. I've had enough of Ken and Barney to last a lifetime. Thank you very much.
I'm flattered.
So you'll think about it? Assuming you and Leslie hit it off.
I don't see why I wouldn't. What's Leslie like?
The partners finally filed out of the conference room around 3 p.m., all of them looking grim. Barney immediately holed up in his office, clearly in no mood to talk. The same went for the other partners. One by one, office doors were closed. Like most of the employees, Maria decided to leave a few minutes early, and on her way out, she noticed that the remaining staff members acted both nervous and scared. Jill had called her again after speaking with Leslie and confirmed plans for the three of them to have lunch on Wednesday. Jill's enthusiasm was infectious, but the upheaval was also causing Maria some trepidation. Changing jobs, changing her practice area again, and joining a startup felt risky to her, even if staying here suddenly seemed even riskier. What she really wanted, she realized, was to talk to someone other than Serena or her parents. Climbing into her car, she found herself driving past Evan's house and the gym, searching for Colin's car before winding her way to Wrightsville Beach. The bar at Krabby Pete's was mostly empty. She was climbing onto a stool before Colin finally noticed her, and she watched his surprise slowly give way to something more reserved.
"Hi, Colin," she said quietly. "It's good to see you."
"I'm surprised you're here." Staring at him standing behind the bar, she thought to herself that he was one of the handsomest men she'd ever met, and felt the same pang of regret she had on Saturday night. She sighed.
"I'm not."
The bar was a good place to talk. The physical barrier between them and the fact that Colin was working kept the conversation from becoming too serious too quickly. Colin briefed her on the fight with Reese and Evan's insistence that the whole thing had been rigged. Maria told him about the dog they'd helped their parents adopt, along with the crisis at the firm and her new career opportunity with Jill. As was typical, he listened without interruption. As always, she had to draw out his explanations and thoughts. But when the time came for her to leave, he asked a waiter to cover for him for a few minutes so he could walk her to her car. He didn't try to kiss her, and when she realized he wasn't going to, she leaned in and kissed him. As she tasted the familiar warmth of his mouth, she found herself wondering why she'd felt it necessary to take a break from him in the first place. At home, the exhaustion of the day finally taking its toll, she fell asleep quickly. She woke to a text from Colin that thanked her for coming by and told her that he'd missed her. Tuesday, the mood at the office was worse than it had been on Monday. While the partners seemed determined to act in a business-as-usual kind of way, the withholding of information was wearing on everyone else. There was little question that most of the office had begun to imagine the worst, and rumors began to fly. Maria heard whispers about layoffs. Many of the employees had families and mortgages, which meant that their lives might just become a lot more complicated. Maria did her best to keep her head down and concentrate on work. Barney remained quiet and distracted. The necessity of focus made the hours pass quickly, and when she finally left the office, she realized she hadn't thought about the stalker at all. She wondered whether that was good or bad. On Wednesday, the lunch with Leslie and Jill went even better than Maria could have hoped. Leslie was in many respects a perfect complement to her best friend in the office. Just as lively and irreverent, but also nurturing and thoughtful. The idea of working side by side with them began to seem too good to be true. After lunch, when Jill popped over to report that Leslie had been equally enthusiastic about the meeting, Maria felt a wave of relief. Jill also walked her through their basic offer, including her salary, which was significantly lower, but at this point Maria didn't care. She would adjust her lifestyle accordingly.
"I'm excited," she told Jill.
She wondered what,
if anything, she should reveal about her stalker or the fact that she and Colin were tentatively back together. And then she realized that she hadn't even mentioned the fact that they'd been broken up. Too much happening all at once. Meanwhile, at Martinson, Hertzberg, and Holdman, the black cloud that had descended on the office grew steadily darker. And as she and Jill approached her office, Jill leaned toward her.
"Don't be surprised if you hear something major tomorrow," she warned.
Indeed, on Thursday morning, word raced through the office that Lynn had filed with the EEOC. Ken, again, was a no-show. Though the report was supposed to be confidential, in an office of high-powered attorneys with favors to call in, it was soon on virtually everyone's computer. Joining the crowd, Maria read through the EEOC charges, which spelled out all the lurid details. The report recounted in blunt and highly specific, often sexual language, Ken's numerous and unwanted advances, including his promises of career advancement and a higher salary in exchange for specific sexual favors. Employees, their worst fears now confirmed, were moving around in a daze. Maria and Jill escaped the office, heading to lunch at their usual time, and discussed when to announce that they'd be leaving the firm. Maria leaned toward the idea of letting Barney know sooner rather than later so he wouldn't be caught in a bind, maybe within a few days.
"He's demanding, but he's also been fair, and I've learned a lot from him," Maria said. "And I have no desire to make things even worse for him."
"That's a valid point, and it's thoughtful, but it might backfire. I'm wondering if we should let the dust settle first."
"Why?"
"Because once you and I announce that we're leaving, it might set off an exodus of other attorneys, which could lead to a death spiral. We announce, then others do, then clients leave, and the next thing you know, even people who were willing to stick around might find themselves out of work.
I'm sure a lot of people are already considering their options."
"I'm sure. I would. But that's not the same as actually resigning." In the end, they compromised on 2 weeks from Friday, leaving Barney with a short window to find a replacement. From there, the conversation moved on to the kind of firm they wanted to create, the kinds of cases they'd take on, how they'd grow their client base, which of their clients might follow them, how much support staff they'd initially need. On Friday, another bomb went off in the office when word raced through the hallways that Heather, Ken's paralegal, and Gwen, the receptionist, had also filed complaints with the EEOC. Their statements as damaging as Lynn's had been. Once again, the partners closeted themselves behind closed doors, no doubt sending death stares in Ken's direction. One by one, associates and staff began leaving the office, some at 3, others at 4. Exhausted from the week, Maria decided to join them. After all, she was planning to meet Colin later and needed time to unwind first.
"I can't imagine how surreal it must have been all week," Colin remarked.
"It's been awful. A lot of people are angry and scared, and practically all of them feel blindsided. They had no idea something like this was coming."
They were at the pilot house again, and though they'd spoken on the phone a couple of times, both of them trying to inch their way back to normal, this was the first time Maria had seen Colin since her visit to Krabby Pete's. In his jeans and white button-down shirt, with the sleeves rolled to his elbows, he looked, impossibly, even better than he had on Monday. Funny, she thought, what even a little time apart could do.
"And Jill?" "A total lifesaver. Without her offer, I don't know what I would have done. It's not as though firms are hiring these days, and I probably would have been a basket case. And Jill's right. With 3 employees filing with the EEOC, it's pretty certain that even if the firm does find a way to survive, all the partners are going to be on the hook financially, and it's going to be grim for the next few years."
"Which probably means they're upset."
"Try furious. I'm pretty sure that they'd all like nothing better than to strangle Ken."
"Doesn't the firm have insurance for things like this?"
"They're not sure it'll cover this. He was clearly breaking the law, and according to the complaints, there are recordings, emails, texts, and one of the paralegals supposedly even has a video."
"Not good."
"No," Maria agreed. "There are a lot of innocent people who are going to get hurt by this.
I can't tell you how fortunate I am.
Okay.
Don't start saying that.
Colin smiled. Okay.
They spent the night rediscovering each other, falling asleep with their limbs intertwined. In the morning, Maria had no regrets and was surprised to catch herself picturing something long-term between them. The thought was strangely thrilling. After they spent Saturday flying kites at the beach, the feeling only continued to grow. On Saturday night, she had dinner with Jill and Leslie while Colin worked. After his shift ended, they met at his place. Evan and Lily were there, and the four of them talked until past 3 in the morning. Unable to stay awake a minute longer, Colin and Maria didn't make love until the following morning. Though she invited him to brunch, Colin begged off with his apologies, citing a number of upcoming exams he had to study for before working another shift that evening. When she arrived at her parents' home, she was pleased to learn that Smokey, the name her parents had chosen for the dog, now had his own rhinestone collar, bed, and various toys strewn throughout the living room, but he seemed most content when snuggled against her father. In the kitchen, Carmen couldn't stop humming. For her part, Serena talked more about Steve than she ever had before.
Okay, maybe it's getting a little serious, she admitted,
eventually submitting to her mother's grilling. At the table, it was Felix's turn to ask about Steve, and all Maria could do was smile. Between her career, her family, and now Colin, things were on the way up. As they cleared the table, Maria realized again that she was no longer obsessing about the man in the baseball hat. Partly because of everything else going on, but also because there'd been no sign of him lately. She wanted to think he'd given up, that he'd finished rattling her cage. But as much as she'd enjoyed the temporary reprieve, she wasn't yet ready to believe it was completely over. Before a rainbow, after all, there's usually a storm. The weather was too cool to paddleboard, and since Colin was occupied, Maria spent the rest of the afternoon and evening trying to catch up on office work. With Lynn absent and Barney operating at less than full capacity, the fact that she'd be leaving in 3 weeks made her feel a bit guilty. Not guilty enough to change her mind, but enough to keep her at the MacBook until her documents became a blur and writing became pointless. When she awoke the next morning, Maria found herself wondering about the coming week, how much worse the mood at the office was going to be, and whether anyone else had made the decision to leave. Most of the partners were as distracted as Barney and Ken, which meant work was probably backlogged in every department, and making new hires was going to be tough once word of the firm's troubles leaked out. No doubt it already had. For now, she resolved to make her own departure as painless for Barney as possible. Hitching her purse over her shoulder, she grabbed her briefcase and headed out the door, her eyes flashing to the doormat. It took a moment to process what she was seeing before her breath caught in her throat. A wilted rose, with petals turning black, along with a note. You will know how it feels. Almost like she was dreaming, her feet remained rooted to the doorstep, because she knew there would be more. On the railing near the steps was another rotting rose that drooped under the weight of another card. Willing her feet to move forward, she stepped over the flower on her doormat and moved closer to read, Why did you hate her? The parking lot outside her door was deserted, the sidewalk empty. No cars she didn't recognize. Her mouth was dry as she locked the door behind her and lifted the rose from the mat. Grabbing the flower that had been threaded through the railing, she forced herself to walk down the steps, her eyes scanning her car. As she'd feared, her tires had been slashed. On the windshield, an envelope was tucked beneath the wiper. Later, she'd be amazed at how calmly she'd handled the discoveries, at the clarity of her thoughts. When she reached for the envelope, she thought about fingerprints and how best to read the letter without damaging any evidence and held the envelope at the creases. In that moment, she felt no panic. Rather, she was overcome with a slow, sinking sensation. A recognition of inevitability. Somehow, some way, she'd known this was coming. The letter, computer-generated, was printed on a single sheet of unlined printer paper.
the kind that could be purchased at any office supply store. The final line, however, had been handwritten in boxy, almost childlike lettering. "You don't think I know what you did? You don't think I know who was behind all of it? You don't think I can see into your mind and know what you did? You have taken the blood of the innocent. Your heart is filled with poison, and you are the destroyer. You poison, and you will not get away with it. You will know how it feels because I am in control now. I am the living, innocent one. See me just as I see you." When she finished the letter, Maria read it a second time, feeling physically ill. The disintegrating rose was still on the windshield, and she reached for it, grouping it with the others in a gruesome bouquet. Turning away from her car, she started back toward her condo, her limbs heavy with dread. The signs, she realized, had been obvious, and she'd willfully ignored them. All at once, memories sparked like blinding visions before her. Gerald Laws being interviewed by the police, with his neatly parted hair and white teeth. Cassie Manning, her young face distorted with fear. Cassie's father, Avery, frighteningly certain of Laws' intentions and possessed of a burning intensity himself. Cassie's mother, Eleanor, mousy and silent and above all, frightened. And finally Lester, the nail-chewing, nervous brother who'd sent her so many terrible notes after Cassie's death. Those awful notes, reflecting his gradually escalating anger, like Laws' letters to Cassie while he was in prison. The first step in a pattern. On the way up the stairs to her door, Maria's cell phone rang. Serena. She ignored the call, needing to talk to Colin. She needed him to make her feel safe. Here and now, she felt exposed. With shaking hands, she dialed him, wondering how soon he'd be able to make it to her place. A pattern. Margolis had told her to come to him with the report, and she wanted Colin there for that as well. She had to tell Margolis about Gerald Laws and Cassie Manning, the woman whom Laws had killed. She wanted to tell him about the Manning family and everything that had happened to her recently. But mostly, she wanted to tell him that she knew exactly who was stalking her and what his endgame was going to be. Chapter 19. Colin. Since he'd started college, Colin had never missed a single class, let alone a whole day's worth. Only once had he come close, a day when his car hadn't started, and he'd hiked to school carrying a backpack loaded with textbooks, arriving just minutes before class had begun. Therefore, today was a first. As soon as Maria had called, he'd raced to her place. He'd read the note, and while Maria had called Margolis, he'd called a tow truck with a flatbed, since her car was essentially resting on its rims. While they waited for the tow truck to arrive, Colin made Maria a cup of tea, but she was only able to take a couple of sips before pushing the cup away. The tow truck came. Once it was gone, Colin drove her to the police station. Maria offered her name to the officer at the front counter, and she and Colin took a seat in the small lobby, noting the steady but unhurried rhythm of the station. Maria took the opportunity to leave a message for Barney, informing him that she wouldn't be in for a while. Margolis, no doubt, was already somewhere in the station, probably buried in paperwork from weekend incidents. As a detective, he dealt with significant crimes, and he was probably regretting the fact that he'd challenged Maria to call him if she ever wanted to make a simple report. Stalking, if what was happening to Maria officially rose to that level, was below his pay grade, and the fact that Colin was with Maria no doubt made the whole thing even more irritating for him. He made them wait nearly 90 minutes before finally showing up carrying a manila file. While he shook Maria's hand, he didn't offer his to Colin, and Colin wouldn't have shaken it if he had. No reason to pretend they liked each other. Margolis asked to speak with Maria alone. Maria insisted that Colin be present. Radiating disapproval, Margolis nodded and led the three of them to one of the interrogation rooms. Having spent time in a number of police stations over the years, Colin knew that on a busy morning, the interrogation room was one of the few places with any privacy whatsoever.
Nice of him, even if he's generally an ass, Colin thought. After closing the door and seating them at the table, Margolis set aside the file he'd been holding, asked a series of general questions, Maria's name, age, address, and the like, and began filling in the report. After that, Maria, in a shaky but surprisingly linear fashion, went through the same story she'd told Colin on the beach about Cassie Manning and Gerald Laws, as well as what had been happening to her recently. She sketched out the parallels before finally handing Margolis the letter she'd found on the windshield. Margolis read the letter slowly, saying nothing, before finally asking if he could make a copy. When she agreed, he rose from his seat and left the room, returning with a copy.
"We'll keep the original letter in the file, if that's okay," he said, his face displaying little of what he was thinking.
Taking his seat again, he read the letter a third time before going on.
"And you're sure that Lester Manning wrote this?"
"Yes," Maria answered. "He's also the guy who's been following me."
"That's Cassie Manning's brother?"
"Younger brother."
"Why do you think it's him?"
"Because some of what's in the letter I heard him say before."
"When?"
"After Cassie died. He also wrote the same types of things in the notes he sent me."
"Like what, specifically?"
"The blood of the innocent, my heart being filled with poison."
Margolis nodded and made another note. "Was this in the first batch of notes, or the second batch?"
"Excuse me?"
"You said the notes changed when they started to arrive again, that they were more threatening and scary?"
"Second group."
"And how do you know he sent the notes?"
"Who else could it be?"
Margolis scanned his notes. "Avery Manning said that it may have been Cassie's boyfriend."
"It wasn't him."
"How do you know?"
"According to the police, he wasn't a credible suspect. He was devastated by Cassie's murder, but he didn't blame me. He denied even knowing who I was."
"Did you ever speak with him?"
"No."
Margolis made another note. "Do you remember his name or how he met Cassie?"
Maria pursed her lips. "I think it was Mike or Matt or Mark, something like that. And no, I don't know how he met Cassie. But why are we even talking about him? Lester is the one who's been stalking me, just like he wrote those notes in Charlotte."
"Didn't you tell me that Lester denied writing the notes when the police talked to him?"
"Of course he denied writing them."
"And it never crossed your mind that it could have been this Michael, the boyfriend?"
"Why would he? He didn't even know me. He told the police he didn't do it."
"So did Lester."
"Have you been listening to me? Lester's crazy. The notes are crazy. It doesn't take much to put two and two together."
"Do you still have any of the original notes?"
Maria shook her head, her frustration surfacing. "I threw them away when I moved here. I didn't want anything to do with them. The Charlotte police might still have a couple of them, but I can't be certain about that."
"When you say notes, what do you mean?"
"Just a sentence or two."
"So, not like this one?"
"No, but again, he used the same words and phrases, and there were two short notes that do fit the pattern."
"In other words, this letter is different."
"Obviously."
Margolis tapped his pen on the report in front of him. "Okay, let's say it is Lester. When you say his notes were threatening, what do you mean? Did he say he was going to hurt you in any way or harm you?"
"No, but it was clear that he blamed me for his sister's death. Actually, his whole family blamed me in the end."
"What was the family like?"
"They were just odd," she said. "Their whole dynamic, I mean."
"How so?"
Colin turned toward her, realizing that he hadn't heard Maria talk about them in much detail. "Avery Manning, the father, was a psychiatrist, and from the very first meeting, he considered himself an expert when it came to criminal behavior. He never let Cassie meet with me alone. He was always there, and he dominated the conversations. Even in the hospital, when I was trying to get the story from Cassie, he would answer for her. It got to the point where I had to ask him to step out of the room, but he refused. The most he would do was retreat to the corner, promising to remain silent while she talked. Even then, I had the sense that Cassie was very careful with her words, like she was trying to say things exactly the way that he wanted, almost like they'd rehearsed. I think that's why she embellished her stories at times."
embellished.
Cassie told me that Laws had hit her before. If true, that would have been important, because we might have been able to make a more serious charge stick. Cassie told me that Laws struck her in a parking lot and that Lester had witnessed it. Both Cassie's and Lester's stories were identical, almost word for word, but when we investigated, we learned that Laws was in another state on the date and time in question, which meant they both were lying. When we talked to Cassie about it, she wouldn't back down. That only made the plea bargain even more necessary. Laws' attorney would have had a field day with her if she had to testify.
And the mom?
Eleanor. I only met her twice and she was completely under Avery's thumb. I'm not sure she ever said anything, just wept the whole time.
Margolis continued to jot notes as she talked.
Now let's talk about Lester. What was he like?
Again, I only met him twice, and he was like two entirely different people. In the first meeting, I didn't notice anything out of the ordinary. The most normal of the bunch, in fact. But when I met him the second time, after I informed them of the charges against Laws, he changed. Almost like he was afraid of me. He'd mutter that I shouldn't be here, that no one in the family should be near me because I was dangerous. His father kept telling him to be quiet, and then he'd just sit there, fidgeting and staring at me like I was in league with the devil.
Do you know the name of the psychiatric hospital where he was committed?
No.
But the notes eventually stopped.
After I moved, but now he's doing it again.
Margolis twirled the pen before reaching for the file he'd originally brought into the room.
After you called, I had the Charlotte police email the report about Cassie Manning's death. I'm still waiting on the report on Laws' initial arrest. I haven't really had the chance to dig through it all in detail, but from what I did read, it's clear that Gerald Laws killed Cassie Manning. Furthermore, you didn't make the decision that allowed him to plead to a misdemeanor in the first place. It was your boss. Am I correct?
Yes.
Then why do you think the Manning family blamed you, or in Lester's case, viewed you as dangerous?
Because I was the one they were dealing with. They were counting on me to convince the DA to go for the more serious conviction. And in Lester's case, he's obviously ill. Like I said, he ended up in a psychiatric hospital.
Margolis nodded.
Okay, let's say you're right about all of this and that Lester Manning is indeed responsible for everything that's been happening to you.
He leaned back in his chair.
Even then, I'm not sure that there's anything I can do.
Why not?
You haven't seen him. No one else has seen him. You don't know who bought the roses, other than that it wasn't your boss. No one saw Lester put the roses into your car. All you know about the guy who ordered you a drink was that it was a young man wearing a baseball hat. Nor did you recognize the guy who delivered the roses as Lester. In other words, you have no proof that it actually is Lester.
I told you that the note used some of the same phrases.
You mean when compared to the notes you don't have anymore? Again, I'm not saying that you're wrong. In fact, I think there's a good probability that you're right. But as a former prosecutor, you know what the phrase beyond a reasonable doubt means. And right now, there's not enough for an indictment under the stalking statutes.
He's been following me, watching me, and monitoring my actions. That meets the course of conduct required in the law. He wrote a note that terrifies me. He slashed my tires. That constitutes harassment. His actions have caused substantial emotional distress, which is why I'm here. He's clearly stalking me, and that's a crime.
Margolis raised an eyebrow.
All right, Miss Former Prosecutor. But if he denied writing the notes once, he'll just deny it again. And then what?
What about the pattern? Notes, flowers, following me around, dead flowers. He's mimicking what Laws did to Cassie.
The pattern is similar, but not the same. Laws sent letters and identified himself. You received short, unsigned notes. Laws spied on Cassie at dinner and made sure she knew he was there. Someone bought you a drink at a club, anonymously. Cassie knew that Laws had sent her flowers. You don't even really know for sure who sent you the roses.
It's close enough.
To you, maybe. But in a court of law, it's different.
In other words, because he's been careful, he's going to get away with it? You're not even going to talk to him.
Don't get me wrong. I'll try to talk to him.
Try?
You're assuming that he's still in town and that I can find him. On the other hand, if he's in Charlotte or another city, I'll probably have to turn it over to a detective there.
And what would you say to him if you were able to find him?
I'll let him know that I know what he's up to, and that it's in his own best interest to stop, or the authorities will intervene. When it became clear that Maria hadn't expected him to say what he had, Margolis went on. In other words, I believe you. With that said, I can't arrest him because you think he bought you roses, or because you think he bought you a drink, or because you think he put a note on your car. You and I both know that's not going to fly. And in the end, he might make things even worse for you.
Excuse me? She asked.
Margolis shrugged. You made an accusation before, and the father threatened to sue you and the police. Now you're accusing him again. It's possible that he could make a claim for harassment against you.
That's ridiculous!
But it's possible.
What am I supposed to do then? If you're not going to do anything to help me?
Margolis leaned forward, folding his hands on the table. I've taken your statement, and the report will now be on file. I told you I would talk to him, assuming I can find him, or that someone else will. I'll review the files on Laws's arrest and Cassie's death, and I'll find out what I can learn about Lester Manning. I'll talk with the Charlotte police and have them check whether the old notes are in a file somewhere. Considering you've offered me nothing whatsoever in the way of proof that you've been threatened at all, and taking into account your questionable judgment in choosing a boyfriend, I'd say that's more than enough, wouldn't you?
Maria's face was a mask. What about a restraining order?
Anything is possible, but you and I both know it's not automatic, for all the same reasons we've discussed. But let's say that by some miracle, a judge does grant one. The law says that it's not valid unless Lester Manning can actually be served, which again, may or may not be possible.
In other words, you're telling me to pretend it isn't happening.
No, I'm telling you to let me do my job. He reached for the file. I'll let you know what I find out.
I don't know why I went to him in the first place, Maria said on her way back to the car, her face tight. And you know what really pisses me off? She didn't need an answer. He's right. About all of it. And I know he's right. If a detective had brought me a case like this, I would have turned him away. There's nothing in the way of proof. Even if I know it's him.
Margolis will check into it.
So what?
Margolis may be an ass, but he's smart. He'll get Lester to say something incriminating.
And then what? You think Margolis will convince him to stop? I thought it was over when I moved here, but even that didn't end it. He knows where I live, and for all I know, Lester killed Coppo. He might have been inside my parents' house.
It was the first time that Colin had heard her link Coppo's death to everything else that had occurred, and her obvious fear made something coil inside him. This was going to stop. Let Margolis do whatever he was going to do, but right